Earlier this week, we asked you to call in with your questions about a possible war with Iraq, and today we'll try our best to answer them. Helping to provide the answers today are NPR's national security correspondent, Tom Gelton. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, Melissa.
And Ivo Dalder. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
And let's get right to the questions.
This is Lorraine Traber from Hendersonville, Tennessee. And my question is, so far, what is the cost of the deployment of the troops to the Middle East, and what is the expected estimated cost for the first strike? Thank you so much. Bye.
Tom, that was the most asked question among the listeners who called in. Any answers?
It's also the most asked question on Capitol Hill, I think, and all around town.
And people at the Pentagon.
People are really wondering what this is going to cost. The cost of the deployment so far is impossible to say with any precision, in part because the Pentagon won't say exactly where people are. We know that there are more than 200,000 troops already deployed. That's counting sailors on board ships in the region, as well as Air Force personnel and soldiers and Marines. We have seen some round figures that the overall cost of the war, including deployments, could be as high as $100 billion. As far as the cost of the first strike, the first couple of days are going to be, according to everything we've heard, very intense and could be as much as $500 million per day. Now, there is a couple of figures that we could just throw out. Much of this actually would be jet fuel and munitions. Cruise missiles cost $1 million apiece. Some of the big laser-guided bombs cost about $80,000 apiece. We've heard that there could be as many as 3,000 bombs and missiles dropped in the first day alone. So do the math. You can see that it adds up very quickly.
Ivo, some in Congress are also saying you should factor into that any pledges of loan guarantees or financial support to governments that the U.S. might be making.
Absolutely. And if the Turks, for example, are to vote again and vote this time to allow U.S. troops to deploy, that's $15 billion right there just for Turkey. And of course, when you start a war, it doesn't end the day the fighting stops. In fact, there's a lot going on after that. We're going to have many, many troops for many, many years in this part of the world, and that ought to be part of the cost. And then $100 billion all of a sudden looks cheap rather than expensive.
Here's our next question.
My name is John, and I'm calling from Newmarket, Maryland. And my question is, why don't we do it alone? We seem to be waiting for France to make the last decision, and why don't we just do it alone? We seem weak. That's my question.
Ivo Dalder, what do you think?
We're going to do it alone, virtually alone. We have the Brits with us, which is the only country, together with the Australians, that are going to provide any significant forces with us. The issue is not whether we're going to go to war alone. The issue is, are we going to win the peace alone? Because if we go in without a UN Security Council resolution, without the kind of support internationally that we have been seeking for so many months now, it is well possible that once the fighting stops, all of a sudden we're left to hold the pieces. That's why it's important to get support now, not because we're going to need them when the fighting starts. We're going to need them when the fighting stops.
You know, the United States has made it clear that we'll not allow France, Russia, and China to have the opportunity to veto this. But there is one country that does have the opportunity to veto this, and that is Britain. We can only move as fast, or this administration has made it clear that it will only move as fast as Britain is willing to be pulled. And right now, I think Britain is a brake on the United States.
Okay, our next question is from Tom Stevens in Detroit, Michigan.
What do we know about what United States bombing plans are with regard to Baghdad, what kind of casualty figures and other results, such as creation of refugees, health problems, and whatever else has been studied, can we expect in that event? Thank you very much.
Tom, let's start with you.
I've been surprised, actually, by how much U.S. military officials have been willing to say about the opening phase of this campaign. They've, especially in the last week or so, they've been quite clear that the first 48 hours of this campaign will involve intense bombing in Baghdad. Because of that, I'm afraid that we have to expect there will be more civilian casualties in this war than there were in 1991. The estimate that I've seen most often for 1991 is about 3,500, but we did relatively little bombing in Baghdad, especially after that one terrible incident where a lot of women and children were killed. This time around, if, as is apparently the case, if we do more bombing in Baghdad, I just don't see any way the civilian casualties can be avoided.
Let's move on to our next question.
My name is Paul Seliga, and I live in South San Francisco, California. My question is, why isn't the Congress debating a declaration of war? Since this is not an emergency and the Congress has the sole power to declare war.
Ivo, a lot of our listeners are curious about this. What's the answer there?
Well, of course, we don't declare wars anymore. We just fight them. We haven't had a declaration of war for 50 years or more. But in this case, we actually have had a debate in Congress, and we had a vote in Congress. It just happens to happen last October. We had a debate at that point about whether or not the president ought to be authorized to use force when he judges it to be the right thing to do. We, in fact, had the quite astonishing and novel situation in which Congress decided that the president would be authorized to go to war, even though the president hadn't decided that he was going to go to war. And 6 months later, he still apparently at least says that he hasn't decided about going to war. But Congress has already, in that sense, authorized him to use the force, and they have no more role to play. They abdicated their responsibility last October, and now we're reaping the fruits of that decision.
Our next question comes from Kathy Zucker in Boise, Idaho.
Is there any irrefutable proof that ties Iraq or Saddam Hussein to the tragedies of September 11th. It seems that there's some confusion about this, and I am really curious.
Ivo, can you help clear up that confusion? This comes up all over on Capitol Hill at the UN and with our listeners, too.
And it's in the polls. Some 55% of the American people think that Saddam Hussein is linked to September 11th. We have no evidence. The government has no evidence. Nobody has come up with any evidence to suggest that Saddam Hussein personally, or indeed the Iraqi regime, is in any way linked to what happened on September 11th.
Tom, what about broader links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, for example?
The administration has maintained that there are links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, in fact, gone to the extent of saying that Saddam Hussein is harboring al-Qaeda. There is one fairly senior al-Qaeda person who we know did receive medical treatment in Baghdad. He is now unaccounted for, and he is considered to be very dangerous. But the relation between that particular al-Qaeda person and sort of the rest of the network is a bit vague. It's not clear whether he's right in the center of it or on the fringes of it. The truth is that there is debate about this issue within the intelligence community. The administration has gone about as far as an administration can go in arguing that there is a link. However, to be fair, in response to the caller, the administration has never, ever said that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11.
Here's our next question.
My name is Christine Kubat, and I'm calling from Pahoa, Hawaii. My question is, which companies in the United States stand to gain financially from this war, and which companies are going to manage the oil fields once they are seized, and whether these companies have anything to do with Halliburton? Thank you. Bye.
Tom, a lot of aspects to that question.
Well, we do know of one company that has something to gain financially from this war because they've had a lot to gain from the war on terrorism throughout. And that is it is a subsidiary of Halliburton. It's called Brown & Root. And the reason that it benefits is because it has an open-ended logistics contract with the Army and the Navy. It builds detention facilities. The detention cells in Guantanamo, where suspected terrorists are being held, were built by Brown & Root. They're active in Kuwait. They're active in Central Asia. And presumably, if the United States were to occupy militarily Iraq, Brown & Root would get a big portion of the business.
And Eva, what about the question about the oil fields?
I'm sure that American oil companies are going to be part of the development and redevelopment and reconstruction of the oil fields, particularly if they're destroyed, as are going to be a lot of other oil companies. The oil business now is an international business. The energy market is so internationalized that the notion here, which is in some sense behind the question, as well as a lot of other criticisms about this war, that somehow this war is being fought for economic gain of particular companies, I don't think that is why we're fighting this war. It is far too costly, and the benefits on the other side are going to be far too small. There are going to be individual firms that are going to stand to benefit. There are going to be individuals that stand to benefit, as there would be individual firms and individuals. If we weren't going to go to war, there would be also benefits. There's economic benefit, whatever happens. That's therefore not the reason why we're doing this.
And here's our last question.
My name is Isaac Pickett at Brooklyn, New York. My question is about the opportunities actually for the U.S. to lose. I would like wondering if you could get somebody maybe to discuss what scenarios are possible of actually the United States losing the war against Iraq. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Eva, what do you think?
I think it's highly unlikely that the United States will lose the war. I think the war can go a lot worse, and it can be a lot more messy than we're now considering. We can have the use of chemical and biological weapons, perhaps even in large quantities, which will be very messy and, in fact, very dangerous. We can have intense fighting in Baghdad, almost house to house, leading to a large number of casualties. And those are things we ought to be worried about. In fact, I think our leaders ought to be talking more about the possibility that this war, like every other war, might have some serious problems as it go along. What I'm more worried about is not about losing the war, it's about losing the peace. Because the job that needs to be done once we have won the war, once Saddam is removed, to maintain Iraq as a territorial unit as it is, to maintain the stability, to maintain the security among warring factions, to make sure that the kind of revenge that may well come out after being pent up for 23 years of dictatorship, that all these things are handled well. That's what I'm worried about. We're taking on not just a war, we're taking on a massive generation-long effort to make sure that this country comes out better, not worse, when the fighting stops and the peace has been won.
And Tom, what do we know about Saddam Hussein's military strength?
Saddam has a lot of military strength, but a great deal of it is considered to be unreliable. The entire regular army folded almost immediately in 1991, the time of the Gulf War, and it's likely to again. There are Republican Guard units. A lot of them put up some resistance in 1991, but there's an expectation that many of them will fold as well. It's a very big army, a lot of armor. The divisions that cause the most concern are actually fairly small. The Special Republican Guard units, some of the units that are close to Saddam himself, who will probably in the end surround Saddam in Baghdad or in his hometown of Tikrit, and they may very well have access to, as Ivo said, may have access to chemical or biological weapons. Those are the elements of the Iraqi military the United States is most concerned about.
Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liza.
Tom Jelton is NPR's national security correspondent, and Ivo Dalder is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. And thanks to everyone who called in with a question.